TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Yanis Varoufakis, The European Union and the War on Gaza. Excerpts from an interview by 99 zu 1, a podcast on the channel 99 to 1. Yanis Varoufakis is a Greek economist and politician. He has been an outspoken dissident voice in the Western discourse on the ongoing war in Gaza. Here's Nadim from 99 to 1.
Good morning. We are honored to welcome Yanis Varoufakis. Currently, he's the Secretary General, I think one would say, in English, of DiEM25. And he, in this function, he actively shapes progressive and pan-European political agenda. He has also always been very vocal about Palestinian rights and has recently made some quite impactful statements, on the basis of which he also got cancelled in Vienna. And that's also the reason why today we want to speak about Palestine, Gaza, Israel, and of course also the role of Europe and Germany. First, maybe, Yanis, I will give you the stage. Give us your view on the events unfolding since October 7th, what has happened, and where are we at today?
Well, what we are seeing is the culmination, the apotheosis, the heightening of a very straightforward and extremely sad, depressing act of genocide. The Palestinian people are being subjected to what can only be described as genocide. This is not new. It didn't start on the 7th of October, of course, right? Because there is this very quaint myth that there was a ceasefire between the Palestinians and the Israelis before the 7th of October, and then suddenly Hamas attacked Israel and the war began. That's, of course, absolute rubbish. The war began in 1948 with the ethnic cleansing of 800,000, 900,000 Palestinians during the Nakba. And it never stopped since then. Before the 7th of October, 2 million Palestinians in Gaza were in an open-air prison, in a prison camp. No access to the rest of the world. 60% of the children malnourished because of the embargo. Their water, their electricity, their food, completely regulated by the occupying force, Israel, just because they had moved their troops out of Gaza, didn't stop Gaza from being occupied territory. If anything, it resembled, if anybody remembers that movie by John Carpenter, Escape from New York, where Manhattan become an open-air prison for, you know, for the United States. This is exactly what it was. And on the 7th of October, I remember I was in Berlin when the Hamas attack against Israel took place. I made a name for myself, and as a result, I've been facing a wave, a tsunami of vilification because I refused to condemn the Hamas attack. And the reason why I refused to condemn the Hamas attack in principle, while at the same time saying that any attack against civilians, whether by Hamas on Israeli civilians or by Israelis on Palestinian civilians, is deplorable and violates the Geneva Convention. But nevertheless, any people who have been incarcerated in an open-air prison not only have a right to break down that wall and to attack the army that is keeping them imprisoned, they have a duty to do it. In the same way that prisoners of war have a duty to escape, a population that is caught up in a mass prison camp, I would say concentration camp. I know this is a controversial term in Germany, but it has all the hallmarks, especially now, of a concentration camp, especially now. They have a duty to break out. You know, for progressives, for those who defend human rights, anybody's human rights, Israelis, Palestinians, you know, people in Kashmir, people of Germany, human rights are either universally respected or they don't exist. For anybody who respects human rights, it's always very difficult to steer the right course between defending the right to resist occupation and condemning acts that go beyond the right to resist, like, for instance, rapes, the killing of civilians, taking of hostages, and so on. That was the difficulty. But it's a difficulty that either you face head on or you become complicit in general. Difficulty was how to say, on the one hand, Hamas had every right to attack Israel. It didn't have the right to attack civilians.
So since then, yeah, what people here call a war has broken out, and we see, you already described that as at least genocidal acts, a genocide. Now an ICJ court ruling has come through like 2 weeks ago that at least gives credibility to those claims made by South African politicians there. My question would be, even before that, I mean, looking at 2-3 months ago, the calamity has been ongoing, let's say. Why, and maybe as an ardent believer of, let's say, international law and human rights and ICC, ICJ, etc., why are all these structures so ineffective? Why could this just go on like this?
Well, to begin with, let me contest the word war. This is no war. There's a war in Ukraine between two independent countries, Russia and Ukraine. There's no war in Palestine. It's not a state. Gaza is not a state. Hamas is not a government. Gaza, the West Bank, where just before you and I began talking, Israeli troops disguised as Palestinians entered the hospital in Jenin and executed three patients, three Palestinians in their beds. That's not a war. That's a crime. That's just criminal activity by an occupying force. If only the Palestinians had a state that could wage war, they don't. So let's be clear on this. Why is the international system of legislation and human rights not functioning? Well, the answer is very, very clear. Because the West never cared about human rights or international law. Never. It was always a facade. The United States, Britain, all the European colonial powers, France, Italy, Germany, use the language of human rights as a weapon of colonization. They always did it in their own countries. Think about the Constitution of the United States, which is a beautiful text, the Bill of Rights. It reads like poetry, a celebration of human rights and the rights of man and woman, once assumes. And yet the very same authors of that beautiful document who wrote poetically about freedom were slave owners. So for them, freedom was very precious. For their own caste, for their own class, for their own ilk, but it involved the freedom to have slaves, the freedom to settle other people's lands and to treat them like vermin, to extend the logic of terra nullius in Latin. Terra nullius means empty land, a land without people. Because if you think about it, when the British went to Australia, they declared that Australia is terra nullius, that there are no people here, even though there were 6 million Aborigines. Immediately, what you do when you declare Australia to be terra nullius is you claim that the people there are not humans, therefore you can kill them and you can take their land, since there are no humans there. I'll remind you of the most central Zionist line of the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, land without a people, for a people without a land, that was Palestine. Terra nullius, land without a people. So the Palestinians are not people, therefore you can kill them. The British did this in Kenya, in South Africa, in Australia, and so on and so forth. The Americans have done it in America, championing human rights with great texts like, you know, John Locke's or, you know, the Federalist Papers, right? But not for the people that it wants to expropriate. And the Palestinians fall under the category of those people that need to be expropriated in the interests of anti-Semitic Westerners who really wanted to get rid of Jews from Europe. And they said, okay, you go to a land without a people. So that's a double crime. Firstly, they wanted to get rid of the Jews, to take them far away. And secondly, to deny the Palestinians the right to be called humans.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about Europe's, and in particular, maybe Germans' reaction to all of this. I mean, you were here on October 7th, and also since then, you have, of course, witnessed what's going on. maybe first describe a little bit what you see. How did Europe, how did Germany react to this whole calamity, and why?
A comrade of ours, a friend of ours, Iris Heffetz, who lives in Berlin, is an Israeli Jew who practices as a psychoanalyst in Berlin. A few days after the 7th of October, she came out on the street in Berlin on her own, completely on her own, with a placard that she had actually written on, as an Israeli and as a Jew, stop the massacre in Gaza. This is an Israeli Jew. And there comes a bunch of German white policemen and women and arrested her for spreading anti-Semitism. You can't make this up. White, Aryan, German police arresting an Israeli Jew for spreading anti-Semitism because she's saying, not in my name as a Jew should a massacre take place. I don't think I need to add more. I think that is the situation in Germany. It is absurd. Now, why is this happening? It is happening for a number of reasons. Of course, there is a collective guilt in Germany, as there should be, over the Holocaust. I think that this is a very good thing. I think Germans should bear a collective guilt over the Holocaust. I think that all Europeans should bear a collective grief and guilt over the Holocaust, because it wasn't just the German Nazis. It was the Croat Nazis, it was the Serb Nazis, it was the French Nazis, it was the Dutch Nazis, it was the Lithuanian Nazis, it was the Polish Nazis, it was the Greek Nazis that partook in the execution of the Holocaust. The whole of the European continent is tainted by anti-Semitism, by pogroms before the Nazis even came around, and of course by the Holocaust. But the question that I pose to my German friends is, how many rivers of Palestinian blood, how many of those does it take to wash off your guilt over the Holocaust and allow you to say, never again, even for the Palestinians? To what extent are you going to tolerate the genocide of the Palestinians in order to extinguish your guilt over the Holocaust so that you can at some point say, no more genocide of the Palestinians? And I get no answer to that. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect to this is that you have a complete breakdown in anything that could resemble European sovereignty when it comes to foreign policy. You see, once upon a time, we had politicians in Germany, in France, here in Greece, who were pro-NATO, they were pro-American, they were, you know, representatives of their capitalist class, but could nevertheless stand up to Israel, even mildly. I remember, for instance, Jacques Chirac, the president of France, or Willy Brandt before that, who were very strongly opposed to anti-Semitism, who had supported Israel, Israel's right to exist, and all that, but at the same time, who looked the Israeli officials in the eye and said that what is happening in the occupied territories is unacceptable. Jacques Chirac physically confronted the Israeli army. I can't imagine this happening today with Olaf Scholz or with the Greek prime minister. We have politicians in power whose incapacity to contest not so much Israel, but the will of Washington, D.C., American hegemony. Effectively, they defer to Washington, whatever Washington says. You know, they're expecting the Washington line and then just do it. That, I think, reflects very significantly the complete loss of European capitalism's autonomy from the United States after the 2008 great financial collapse. After 2008, the flimsy structure of the European Monetary Union gave rise to a series of domino effects. First, it was the German banks. It was Deutsche Bank, Finanzbank, and all the other German banks that went bankrupt because of the stupid, stupid bets they had placed on the American subprime market. And that domino effect took down every single European bank. There wasn't a single European bank in early 2009 which was not bankrupt. That immediately triggered a bankruptcy of states, with Greece being the first one. Then it was Ireland, it was Portugal, it was Italy, it was Spain, and so on, right? And the reaction to this deep crisis of European financialized capitalism was a kind of political program, which I sum up as socialism for the bankers and harsh austerity for everyone else, including the German working class. That created a collapse in investment, a very large increase in the amount of money available because the central banks were printing money. So you've got a lot of money and very little demand by the little people. And that created a deep recessionary undercurrent with lots of money for the rich. So inequality increased, and you had a social democratic left that had gone to ground. It was complicit in this. They were part and parcel of this. So all the discontent, who could express it? The ultra-right, the xenophobes, the fascists, who sided with Israel against the Muslims. So anti-Semitism was traded for Islamophobia. In this context, with the United States recovering, because they had a solid political and monetary system, unlike Europe, which doesn't have a solid political and monetary system. They have the Fed. The ECB is nothing like the Fed. They have the federal government. You know, they can sit around the table and make a decision like that. Whereas the European Union supposed leaders, they can talk for hours, and they simply do as they're told in the end by bureaucrats. So the result of this inane handling of the inevitable euro crisis, as I call it, was the complete loss of European sovereignty. European capitalism became a vassal. It was always a vassal to American capitalism, but it became far, far more. And that is reflected in our politicians. That's why no politician in Europe, even if, let's say that, you know, Olaf Scholz has an epiphany and suddenly sees the light about Palestine, he won't be able to say anything. Because the whole of the media structure in Germany, the whole of the media structure in France, the whole of the military-industrial complex, the way in which Germany has been, the German business model is now kaput as a result of having to buy very expensive Texan gas instead of much cheaper Russian gas. I'm not arguing the case for going back to Gazprom, but I'm simply being objective in my analysis. He wouldn't be able to say that, you know, what he thinks. Macron, I have no doubt, and Scholz think that what's happening in Ukraine is a crime against logic. The forever war against Russia until Moscow falls. You know, that's a stupid idea. I'm sure Scholz and Macron believe that. They would never be able to say it. Unlike what was going on before 2008, when even Schroeder and back then Sarkozy, you know, said no to the invasion of Iraq. They would never be able to do that. And that's because after 2008, Europe has become the stupid continent. I believe that seriously. I've seen it in action, even for a very few months when I was, sure, you know, in Brussels and in Berlin and so on. I saw them making decisions which they knew were detrimental to the interests of the capitalist classes of Europe, and not being able to coordinate into making decisions which were in their own interests. You know, that's why I'm calling it the stupid continent, our Europe.
It does sound a little bit like the German state would not have any rationale for his policies towards Israel. Is it then really against their interest what they're being, are they being forced to take such a proactive and pro-Israel stance in this conflict? I mean, sometimes you even believe, especially when you look at the media, that the Germans are outrunning the US in terms of support for the Israelis.
These are very complicated processes, so there's not a single silver bullet kind of answer to answer it all. There's a conjunction of forces. But look, I remember Willy Brandt, because I'm getting old enough to remember Willy Brandt, and Bruno Kreisky in Austria, because Germany and Austria are the two countries whose post-war ideology has been framed, as you put it, in terms of supporting Israel and collective guilt over the Holocaust, which I think is right. I think, you know, having the collective guilt over the Holocaust is appropriate. It is right and proper. But Bruno Kreisky and Willy Brandt combined that with a support for a Palestinian state. They combined that with support for Palestinian organizations. Today, what you have in Germany is full complicity in the eradication of any claims on behalf of Palestinians. And that, to me, is not simply the result of the post-war ideology, because Willy Brandt and Bruno Kreisky were part of that too. For me, this is a deeper issue. Let me take you somewhere completely differently, to a different realm, China. Germany is absolutely reliant on a good trade relationship with China. German capital is going to lose, and it's already losing, enormous capacities to reproduce itself, to accumulate. As a result of the new Cold War that Donald Trump began against China, and Joe Biden is turbocharging. German capital only has to lose from that. The German capitalist class has every reason to oppose America and its pursuit of the new Cold War against China. Because this new Cold War against China, which now comes with euphemisms like de-risking and de-globalization and so on, that is, you know, that's the death knell of the German business model, especially after the European periphery has stopped having the capacity to absorb the net exports of the of German industry. And those net exports can only go to China. And German companies need to develop, for instance, you know, Volkswagen is hiring, as we speak, 3,000 Chinese engineers to develop autonomously driven and battery driven cars in China, because there is a dearth of engineers in Germany. And yet, Washington proves daily its capacity to force upon the German political elites participation in increasing the pace of the conflict between the West and China. So you see what I mean? The German capitalist class, the German political class, which represents the German capitalist class, are simply being railroaded by the interests of the American ruling class and the American political class in policies, foreign policies, that are not in the interest of the German capitalist class. Now, I think the same thing applies to Israel and Ukraine. Israel, Ukraine, China are three such brilliant examples, I think, of where German rulers, whether they are economic rulers or political rulers, are being railroaded into following policies which are not in their own interests.
Okay. If what you just said is holds, and then we have all these institutions that are being used by these powers for their interest, especially the West, or maybe how you put it, the United States' interest. And then we have the situation in which all of this culminates in kind of total impunity for Israel to do what it is doing right now. What is the solution to all of this? That it turns out to be, you know, beneficial at least for the people in Gaza.
The only silver lining I see in this preposterous suffering of the Palestinian people is that the events of the last 3 months, 4 months, have made it impossible that we will continue along the lines that we had before of the Palestinians being ethnically cleansed and eradicated at a slow pace without the world looking at them. If there is one thing that is giving me heart and hope of, you know, what's been happening the last 4 months, is that the Arab world, the corrupt regimes of the Arab world, would no longer be able to make peace with Israel while ignoring the Palestinians. The crisis, the massacres, the ongoing quick pace genocide is capable of creating within Israel as well, within Saudi Arabia, within Egypt, within Germany, to create a new process that will one day, I hope, that's the only hope that we've got left, bestow upon the Palestinian people rights which they are now missing, and they've been missing since 1948. What was going on before 7th of October? You see, I really want to challenge the idea that everything was fine until Hamas decided on the 7th of October to attack Israel. Nothing was fine. You know, the world was being complicit in turning a blind eye to the slow asphyxiation of the Palestinian people. So let us just hope that this acute increase in the pain of the Palestinians is going to bring about the end of the slow genocide and the beginning of new forces. You see, I'm a humanist. I believe I have a stupid optimism about human nature. I'd like to think that some of the soldiers now of the Israeli, of the IDF, who are in Gaza killing people indiscriminately, who are in Jenin today in the hospital killing people, so on. You know, when they demobilize and they go back home to Tel Aviv, to Haifa, to wherever, they will start having sleepless nights over what they've done, of what they were ordered to do. When I see the former director of Mossad coming out in The Guardian with an interview in which he confessed that they were imposing apartheid on the Palestinians and that that cannot be a sound basis for a good life for Israelis, that is the kind of thing that I'm talking about. And yes, let's keep fighting without concern about being cancelled, about being called anti-Semites, when we are completely solidaristic with our comrades in Israel, Jews who are proving what it means to be anti-racist, in the same way that they were. Remember what Hannah Arendt said, that if there was one German who died in Auschwitz opposing the Hitler regime, then you can't blame Nazism on Germans. Similarly, as long as there is one Jew in, and there are many in Israel, who fights against apartheid, then you can't blame the Palestinian genocide on the Jews at large. What you can blame it on is the governments of the West, who are the main culprits in perpetrating the Palestinian genocide.
Yanis, thanks so much for visiting us. It was a great honor to have you here, hopefully not the last time. And I wish you all the best, Yanis.
You too. Thank you.
See you soon. Bye.
You heard excerpts from a 45-minute interview with the economist and former Greek Minister of Finance, Yanis Varoufakis. Thanks to Nadim at 99:1, a podcast on the channel 99:1. Yanis Varoufakis is a dissident voice in the Western discourse on the ongoing war in Gaza. Since 2018, he has been Secretary General of the Democracy in Europe movement, that's DiEM25. Nadim from 99:1 spoke with him on February 2nd, 2024. You can find the full interview on YouTube under the title The European Union and the War on Gaza. Please support the work of 99:1. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.